It's season 2, episode 15 of The Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. I'm Gita Pensa. Welcome back. Today we are diving into a particularly high stress and high stakes area of legal exposure for physicians. We're going to talk about governmental investigations and prosecutions against doctors, usually for healthcare fraud. When doctors think about getting sued, most of us are thinking about medical malpractice claims brought by patients, and that indeed is the usual focus of this podcast. But governmental litigation is a totally different beast and can have some very serious consequences, and I thought it was probably time that we took a look at it. So to help me do that, I have a highly esteemed healthcare law attorney here to help us understand the basics of these investigations, lawsuits, and prosecutions. Anthony Box, or Tony as he likes to be called, is an attorney who represents businesses in all types of civil and white-collar defense cases, regulatory investigations and enforcement actions, and compliance matters focused on preventing government inquiries and minimizing business disruptions. Though now representing doctors, he has experience prosecuting doctors as well. He's been a United States attorney for the U.S. Attorney's Office, a special agent for the FBI, and in addition to his service in federal law enforcement, other experiences include working as a CPA and fraud investigator at a Big Four accounting firm, and as a tank commander and JAG officer in the U.S. Army with military and civilian service in Iraq and Afghanistan. He holds degrees from the Washington University of St. Louis School of Law, as well as the Harvard Kennedy School. And I am so glad to have him here to talk us through this very difficult topic. Mr. Box, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Is it okay if I call you Tony?
Yes, it is.
So why don't you start off telling the listeners of this podcast just the overview of what it is that you do and how you help doctors?
So what I do is I'm a defense attorney and I help doctors in defense of cases brought by various agencies, usually with the U.S. government, DOJ, and other agencies.
Yeah. So what we're going to be talking about is when doctors are involved in litigation involving the government, which is a bit of a different beast than medical malpractice litigation, which is what I'm usually talking about on this podcast. But a few people have reached out and asked if I could do a high level discussion about that type of litigation, because unfortunately, that seems to be becoming a little more common. So we're going to be talking about the DOJ, the Department of Justice's war on healthcare fraud, and how doctors, even very well-meaning ones, can get caught up in it. Does that sound good to you?
Yes, it does.
So can you walk us through first the major factors that will land a physician in the crosshairs of the Department of Justice today?
There are many. But some of the ones that I see frequently are large billings, frequent billings. For example, if you are the number one biller in your practice area in a given region or city or state, and you are an outlier, then the government wants to know why. And so they will investigate your billings. Another is the use of analytics and AI when there is a specific target practice or government priority area. And then if you happen to be in that area, for example, COVID fraud is one we may talk about later, and then that you can end up in the government's crosshairs from there. But another is if there's a whistleblower and you become on the government's radar, then they will investigate you for that.
So we're saying the government, what agency is actually bringing the litigation against the physician in these cases? So like for reference, usually in medical malpractice litigation, as our listeners know, that is civil litigation. And there is one party who is the plaintiff who's bringing a lawsuit against the doctor who becomes the defendant. But in this case, the plaintiff is the government, I suppose, right? Is it the government in general? Is it the Department of Justice? Like, who is actually filing litigation against the doctor?
The agency actually filing the litigation is the Department of Justice, which I will refer to throughout today as DOJ. If you read a caption, it always says the United States of America versus the defendant. And so that's also very intimidating. So the United States government is bringing a case against a doctor or hospital or medical group, and they are a behemoth. Actually, they are the biggest behemoth you can encounter because they have unlimited resources and armies of lawyers to fight you.
Let's get into this. You used to be on the other side, right? You were an FBI agent who investigated these types of allegations.
I did. I was an FBI agent who investigated various fraud crimes, including healthcare. And I worked some very significant healthcare fraud cases. And years later, I became a federal prosecutor for the DOJ, also called an assistant United States attorney. And I prosecuted these types of cases.
And now you defend them. So you have a particular type of insight into how these things work. You and I met at the American Bar Association's healthcare law conference. We were both speakers there. And I was just so intrigued by the things that you were talking about that I did not know about. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us about this, because I think you're going to help out a lot of people.
Thank you. You're welcome. I'm happy to speak. And I think one of my missions is to make people aware it's our government and we should know how they work and what are the ins and outs and the landmines to stay away from. And as a person who's been in the government, I think it's my responsibility to tell others about how the government works.
Thank you again. So let's get into some of the nitty-gritty of this. So much of the litigation that we're talking about, where it's going to be the United States government versus a doctor, stems from the False Claims Act, or the FCA. So what I learned from you is that in 2023, FCA judgments and settlements exceeded $2.6 billion. This is all money coming from doctors and practices in the United States. $2.6 billion in FCA judgments and settlements, which is sort of mind-boggling. So can you give us a quick overview of the False Claims Act? They all have to have these theories of liability, like theories of how the doctor went astray. Like, what are common theories of liability under the FCA that a doctor might find themselves facing?
Sure. I'll be happy to talk about the FCA, but I'll also talk about a couple of other acts which you commonly find doctors prosecuted under. Now, the FCA is the most common, you know, what you see and read about 9 times out of 10, but there are also other statutes, and the government uses those statutes to prosecute doctors. But the False Claims Act makes it a crime to defraud the government in any way. It's used in healthcare is the biggest area, but they also use it in other aspects, you know, mail fraud and postal fraud. Any way you defraud the government can bring a False Claims Act case. But that's the catch-all category. And the others are, as regards to doctors, are physician self-referral law, also known as the Stark Act, which prohibits providers from referring patients to facilities in which they have a financial interest, and the anti-kickback statute, which we refer to as AKS, which was enacted in 1989, and it prohibits paying for referrals for generating federal healthcare benefits or businesses.
All right. So the FCA, Stark, and the anti-kickback statute are going to be the majority of these things. So basically, there are things like improper financial relationships and questions about medical necessity, questions about whether you're billing for, you know, either worthless services or over billing or upcoding. What else am I missing here?
There's a plethora. And they grow by the day.
Oh, no. Okay.
We commonly see new theories of the government, and I'll talk about one of them later, utilizing a state law to prosecute healthcare fraud cases when there's no involvement of federal money. The ones that you name are probably some of the most common ones. Upcoding is what we see frequently. But there's others, as you mentioned.
So here's my first real question. False Claims Act is supposed to really be applied when a physician has knowingly committed fraud. Do you see well-meaning physicians who were not intentionally committing fraud fall into this type of investigation and litigation? Or are we just talking about bad actors here?
No, we're not simply talking about bad actors. Yes, well-meaning doctors do get caught up in these cases. They get charged in these cases, and they have to defend themselves in these cases quite frequently. And it does require knowingly. However, that's subjective in the government's mind before they bring the case. And so you're rarely going to have a smoking gun or evidence like an email that says, let's commit fraud, or recording or something of that nature. So the government is going to look at your billing practices and determine in their mind that you knowingly committed fraud. All types of doctors get caught up who did not know what was going on.
Oh my gosh. Okay. And given the complexity of Medicare billing rules, it seems like it's very possible for a well-meaning physician to unknowingly step into committing fraud or something that would have the optics of the government saying it smells like fraud.
It's very common, and it happens to a number of doctors practicing in all different areas. As you said, it's so incredibly complex that no one can stay abreast of all the billings, items, and requirements. Even if you have help, that person frequently does not know all the aspects of billing, and they can make a mistake, an honest mistake, and end up in the government's crosshairs.
Let's say this is an honest mistake, and they just sort of ran afoul of one of these complex rules. They will be investigated. Could they be prosecuted anyway? Like, how can they protect themselves?
They could be prosecuted. You protect yourselves in a number of ways. One is keeping great records to show that you did not intend, to show that you attempted to abide by the law. Several ways to do that. One is to have a compliance program. Another is to have policies and procedures. Another is to bring experts, including medical professionals, billing professionals, lawyers, to say what I'm doing is correct. For example, if you have an arrangement with another doctor or hospital or practice group, but frequently people run that by lawyers to ensure that they are correct. So you can have a defense. The government comes knocking and they want to investigate you for your arrangement or your billing. And so those are some of the ways to protect yourselves, but you can never protect yourself fully from an investigation, because it can come from random places, and it can also come from disgruntled people or people who are unfamiliar with the intricacies of your practice, and they think you're committing fraud, but you're not.
All right, we're going to talk about whistleblowers in a second. But what are the organizations, other than the Department of Justice, that might start an external investigation of your practice?
So the Department of Justice will always prosecute the case. They will not investigate the case. Most often, the investigation will occur from the FBI or the Department of Health and Human Services, OIGs, which stands for Office of Inspector General, which are the law enforcement agents which investigate federal healthcare frauds. So that's most often. But you also have state investigators with robust investigative arms who investigate Medicaid fraud in their state.
Okay, so any of these organizations can start an investigation. It's their job to keep tabs on what's happening and what doctors or any sort of clinician that has a practice, really, what they're doing in the community and what they're billing for. And then if their investigation turns up evidence that you have committed some sort of fraud or a crime, then it gets referred to the DOJ for prosecution. Do I have that right?
That is correct. In a federal context, it gets referred to the DOJ prosecution, and in the state context, it gets referred to the attorney general. And it's also possible that there are state and federal prosecutions together in collaboration. So there are healthcare fraud task forces. I had a case where a state patrol individual, she came out to interview a doctor, and he left a business card. So when the individual called me, I called the state agent. And I just assumed that it was a state matter, but it turned out that the state agent was part of a federal task force, and it was actually a federal healthcare investigation that was using state resources. So it can become complicated.
Wow. Okay. Now, to complicate matters further, once the DOJ is going to file some sort of a action against you, is it a civil action or are we talking criminal?
It can be either or both. So what we see in my practice and in many other practices is a large number of civil cases. And just as a background, the civil cases are the government suing you for some sort of fraud. And what they're seeking is some sort of monetary damage, more often than not. A civil remedy, you cannot go to jail. Now, the criminal prosecutions, what they're seeking is a criminal indictment and a prosecution and very likely jail time. And so it's always important to know what you're dealing with when you interact with the government, because different prosecutors investigate different types of matters. Usually there's a clear delineation. There are civil prosecutors and there are criminal prosecutors. And in my practice, when we have a civil case, we're usually pretty relieved because the damages are limited and the jail time is not there if it's a civil case.
So this is the part where everyone starts to sit up and get a little afraid about jail. Can you tell me, in medical malpractice litigation, one of the things that I say to reassure people often is that, you know, many cases are no-pay cases. They're often dropped. Among those, you know, a good percentage of those that are settled, the ones that go forward, and very, very few of those, maybe 8 to 10% of the time, that case will go to trial. And usually the doctor wins, like 80 to 90% of the time in medical malpractice civil litigation. Those are not the kinds of numbers we're talking about here. Am I right?
Yes. In a case involving the Department of Justice will win more than 90% of the time. And sometimes it's a high 90% of the time. And there are various reasons for that. When you say a win, I'm also speaking about some sort of a settlement where the government extracts a settlement out of the defendant. And so, yes, usually if they bring a case, they will win.
Let's just get into the why of that. If there are that many well-meaning physicians who sort of wind up in this process and they really feel like they didn't commit any sort of crime, why is it that that number is so high? Like, I don't think that we're talking about billions of dollars in a year. In my head, I just don't think that that many doctors are willfully committing fraud. So what happens?
Well, let's talk about it in a different context, the two contexts, the civil and the criminal. In the civil context, there's a lawsuit that the government is seeking some sort of monetary fine or damages where they want money. And oftentimes it is so incredibly difficult to defend yourself against the federal government, it becomes very expensive, time consuming, emotionally draining, that many people say it's only money and I will settle in order to get this thing behind me. I don't want to go to trial and then the government assesses triple damages, which they can do under FCA cases. And then I'm ruined for life and I have to fight this case for years because that's how long it will take to wind its way through the criminal justice system. And so it will take a long time, especially if you have insurance or if the amount they're seeking is something you can handle. People just pay to make the case go away.
So that's an important point to make, I think. And this is a question a lot of listeners will have, is whether or not defense in this type of litigation will be covered by their malpractice insurance policies.
It depends. Some policies will cover fraud, intentional acts, and things of that nature. It's usually DNO, which stands for directors and officers, or ENO, stands for executives and officers, and malpractice policies and other general liability policies sometimes cover it. I have had many cases where doctors' defense costs, as well as their settlement amounts, were covered by insurance. What you will hear is that fraud and intentional acts are never covered by insurance, and that is patently false. So it takes a careful reading of your policy to determine whether defense costs and settlement costs are covered. And it may appear that they are not, but oftentimes, of course, the insurance company's first line of defense or first response is, we don't cover this. But there are ways to fight the insurance company and to argue that certain types of actions are covered. If they're not explicitly stated in the policy that they will cover, it's still a possibility.
I see. So would you work with a client to help them explore those avenues?
Yes. Usually every law firm has a person within their law firm or a resource outside of their law firm would take the policy and will examine it closely. The insurance people who that's all they do. And they will tell you this allegation is covered or it's not covered, or it may be covered, but we're going to have to file a claim and possibly fight the insurance company.
I'm sort of getting this feeling that, and tell me if I'm wrong, these investigations are going up, prosecutions are going up, particularly anything where they can extract a settlement. In a time when everyone's worried about Medicare funding and all that kind of stuff, is this a way to shore that up? Like, this just seems, I don't want to call it a money grab and have myself be on the DOJ's list, but I mean, like, what is happening?
So the government's argument is there's massive fraud and that they're simply getting after that massive fraud. They need to crack down on bad actors, and this is their way of doing it. A skeptical person will say that it's a money grab and they're over aggressive and they're allocating all these resources. They're hiring all of these individuals who have to have something to do. So they're going after marginal cases and cases which are subjective and charging doctors in order to extract settlements more often than not.
All right. Since you've been on both sides, I'm not going to ask you to commit to one of those viewpoints or another, but I just wanted to put those both out there, but to really make the point that this is becoming more and more common. So physicians should really know the steps that they should take if they find out that they are under investigation. Oh, one other misconception I want to clear up. Okay, there's a couple of misconceptions I got to clear up. One is, here's a question. Let's say I am an employee of a big group. I'm just a cog in the wheel. I just see my patients. I just do my billing, you know, or I don't even do my own billing. I just sort of mark things off on my chart and I chart accordingly and I just submit those things and somebody else does the billing and that kind of stuff. Am I immune from this kind of prosecution because I don't make these decisions? I don't use a billing company. I don't hire the billing company. I'm literally a cog in the wheel. Am I safe?
No, you're not immune. You're not safe in every case. You are ultimately responsible for that bill and you can be charged with fraud. You're marking the bill, right? But if the government believes that you're upcoding on your bills and someone else has done the billing, that does not exonerate you or relieve you of any responsibility. Of course, every situation is different. In some situations, maybe it's the billing company or maybe it's the practice group or the hospital who's actually doing the upcoding or committing the fraud or the alleged fraud. And so you might maybe immune in those cases. But the government's, the overwhelming majority of the cases are against individual doctors. And most doctors don't handle their own billing. So that just tells you that they will come after you, even if you don't do your own billing, because they believe that in your mind, you knowingly committed the fraud.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to make that point. Now, here's another common misconception. What if I am a doctor that doesn't accept Medicare? I don't take Medicare. I don't take Medicaid. I don't want to deal with any of that. I'm a direct pay practice. I am a concierge practice. I don't take any of these things. Am I safe?
No, unfortunately.
Okay, this blows my mind. Okay, go ahead.
Usually, and the United States Supreme Court has said that FCA cases need federal money, right? It needs to have a nexus to receiving or paying money for a federal program. However, there are theories, some are relatively new. There was a case in Texas within the last 5 years with several doctors. It was a large hospital and several doctors were prosecuted and went to jail under a novel theory of what they call the Travel Act. So they didn't prosecute it as a FCA or Federal False Claims Act. They prosecuted under a theory called the Travel Act, where they said you had a state violation and there was bribery, and therefore we can prosecute it in federal court, which they did, and they successfully prosecuted. The defense bar, or people who practice defense like me, was appalled and surprised and said, surely this case, which is novel, and this theory, which is novel, will get overturned on appeal. These doctors will be released. Did not happen. Even if you are not defrauding the federal government, there is a possibility that the government will find a way using a Travel Act or another theory to prosecute you. Now, I'm not saying this is common. The most common involves federal money, but there is other ways as well.
Are there statute of limitations on these cases? Can they just go back forever?
No, they cannot go back forever. There are statute of limitations in the criminal context as well as in the civil context. In the criminal context, it's 5 years, and in the civil context, it's 6 years. However, there are exceptions. One exception is if the government believes that the doctor intentionally hid the fraud, which made it difficult to determine the fraud, then they can go back forever in that case. Or if there's what the government calls a continuing fraud, they can reach back beyond the statute of limitations because you have been doing that for a long period of time.
All right. So this is a lot. How aggressive are federal investigators in these healthcare fraud cases? Like, what are the most common tactics that they use against physicians? Like, is this like a friendly, like, hey, can we come look at your records? Or are we talking like things you might see on TV?
Both. So in my opinion, they can be very aggressive. You will have an agent investigating the case who probably, you will never hear from the agent if he believes you did not commit fraud. His or her mind, he's already determined that you've committed fraud and he sets about a course of action to find evidence of that. And so a variety of ways you'll hear from them, but they're aggressive. They will execute search warrants. They will subpoena documents. In a criminal case, it's called a subpoena. In a civil case, it's called a criminal investigative demand. They will demand a tremendous number of documents from you. They will go to external sources to obtain information. They will bury you in litigation. If there's a civil litigation, there's discovery and things of that nature. And they make it very, very difficult to defend yourself in these cases.
And as you said, they just have endless resources. And they're using AI a lot now, right, to look through. This is how they're finding a lot of their cases, is by using AI.
The government has said that they are using AI, increasingly using AI to find these cases. And so to have technical resources and human resources, I don't know this specifically, but I think you may be correct. I was told by a colleague that a U.S. attorney's office increased the size of their healthcare prosecution team by double, and they didn't even ask for those additional resources. The additional prosecutors showed up at the federal government office and said, hey, we're here to work healthcare fraud cases, and we're sent here by DOJ, and they have to have something to do, right? So they're going to work. Necessarily, that state and that region is going to have more healthcare cases than before.
Wow. All right. I promise that there's going to be a hopeful bent to this summer. Tony, we're waiting for it because right now I'm freaking everybody out. There will be. Okay. But let's just keep talking about some important things. First, let me ask you some what if questions. Okay. So what if you do discover there is an error in your billing? You discover this yourself before someone has investigated you. What do you do? Do you self-report or do you just correct and move forward? What would your advice be?
So there are many ways to handle this, and many doctors and many lawyers approach it differently. But for me, I would self-report, pay the money back. Now, the theories that you then become on the government's radar where you were not on the government's radar before. And people say, why would you poke the bear? And some doctors themselves say that. I don't believe they're going to find this item, this mistake I made. And so why should I pay back this amount of money? What if it's a large amount of money? And what if it's an amount of money that I don't have? I'd rather take the chance that they'll never discover it. That's very risky. And if you self-report and you alert the government, it makes it so much easier for someone like me to defend a case if the government takes this case and we go to trial. I'll tell the jury, look, you know, my doctor self-reported. How could this possibly be knowing fraud? Self-reporting and paying back the money. We should not even be here in this courtroom today.
Okay, that actually makes sense. All right, next what if question. Let's say someone gets a notice of an external investigation. They'll get some sort of an official notice, I presume, that they're being investigated. What do they do?
There are many ways to find out. So sometimes you don't find out to the very end. You are indicted and then you get a call from someone to say you've been indicted and come turn yourself in. Or maybe in some situations, the doctor's just arrested. So I'm taking a worst case scenario first. They show up at your practice area, your office, and they arrest you. And you find out that you've been investigated and indicted. That happens, but it's unusual. Usually, a doctor will get wind of an investigation through external sources, or the government will tell that doctor themselves. In one way, if the agent is conducting an investigation, they're going to be issuing subpoenas and civil investigative demands. And frequently, the doctor will hear about it. And so someone calls and says, hey, agent showed up in my place of business today asking about you and about your practice. So then you know you're under investigation. Sometimes they will send what's called a target letter. And they say, you are a target of a federal investigation. We just want to inform you. That happens in my practice all the time. If they know that the person's represented by a lawyer, they'll send that letter to the lawyer. And sometimes they'll send it to the individual. And then the individual from there goes and retains a lawyer. And so these are some of the ways you find out about it. And of course, there's the dramatic. You find out about it because the agents show up at your place of business and they are conducting a search warrant also known as a raid. Then you have to deal with that, but you are formally unnoticed at that particular time.
Wow. Okay. If that happens, let's say it's not the search warrant, because I can imagine what your first call is there. But if it's just that you find out that you do get a target letter or something like that, what's your first move?
It's the same first move as with a search warrant. You call a professional. If these are professionals who do this every day for a living, they know how to extract confessions. They know how to investigate and obtain evidence. And most folks are not equipped to deal with the federal government by themselves. And so you call a professional who knows what they're doing, who practices in this practice area a lot. There's stories abound about people who take cases who are divorce lawyers, or they do car crash cases. They just do not understand. I personally had a case where a lawyer just allowed his client to be grilled for hours in the same room, right? He was there and he did not put up a fight. And so you want a lawyer who practices in this area, who understands the target letter.
Yeah. You want a healthcare law attorney.
Yes. From there, that lawyer will immediately pick up the phone and call whoever signed the target letter to have a conversation.
Yes. And that's something that in conversations with you that I found out that you do. It's like, you know, the people who are on the other side sometimes, or you will be able to talk to them and say like, hey, like, this is not a real case. What are you doing here? Like, those kind of conversations I found to be sort of heartening to me to hear that those things happened.
Yes, they happen every day. You call and you put up a vigorous defense for your client. In reality, prosecutors should only want to bring the best cases and only legitimately fraudulent cases. And if I pick up the phone and I say, I understand why you think that this is a fraud case, but let me explain the context and let me provide you with additional information. In theory, they should say, thank you. I never want to bring a case against an innocent person, which was my theory when I prosecuted.
Okay, that's good to hear. I'm sort of clawing back the good news, Tony. I'm trying here.
Well, I think more prosecutors, they're bad actors in every field, but I think there are more good prosecutors who feel that way than bad ones.
Okay. That makes me feel better. So this landscape, it's changing all the time. You know, once upon a time, nobody cared about opioid cases. And now, obviously, everybody's got to be careful about their opioid prescribing. What are some other enforcement trends that we should be on the lookout for? Like, what are you seeing in your practice?
I'm seeing every aspect of COVID fraud for doctors who did COVID testing or had intentionally related to monies that were allocated for the COVID pandemic. And that is probably a very large percentage of most of our cases.
You're talking about like the Paycheck Protection Program and provider relief funds, those sorts of things?
Yes, those are definitely those types of cases and the number one and the number two type of cases we see. But there was also COVID testing, which was rampant, and the government providing test kits and paying for them for people who did not have insurance. And anyone who made any false statements during that period of time seems to be being investigated.
Yeah. The DOJ has a whole COVID fraud enforcement task force thing going on, I think.
And it's large.
Okay.
As you mentioned, the pill mill and the opioid cases are still common. Telehealth is a very big one now.
In telehealth, what are they going after in telehealth?
Not seeing the patient or not having a true doctor-patient relationship and just kind of being a mill or a doctor who doesn't provide care. They're just cycling through individuals, making a ton of money by not really seeing the case, seeing the individuals.
What about private equity firms and their ownership in companies that are subject to FCA? Who's getting charged in those sorts of cases when private equity is involved? Is that still just the doc, or is the private equity company also on the hook?
So private equity historically has been able to not have to subject themselves to these types of prosecutions or charges because they are far removed contractually from the fraud. They're the owners, but the hire management companies and other entities are between a private equity firm. And so if there's charges against a doc or a hospital, then that's the private equity firm's defenses. That's not me. That's the doctor or hospital. And I, as the owner, private equity firm, I just simply invested money and I did not have knowledge of any type of a fraud. And so that is historically been the defense. But lately, prosecutors are attempting to pierce that veil and are going after private equity firms more and more.
There's a part of me that says that's good news, but okay. I won't opine on that too much. Okay, so there's a lot of things to be, a lot of ways to get in trouble. I think those are the trends that we should be thinking about. Of course, there's good old garden variety fraud of any sort and all the traditional cases. But let's finish up by talking about whistleblowers. This is so interesting to me. Why are whistleblowers so important to this process?
Whistleblowers are the number one source of cases for the federal government. And they are also the number one source of recoveries. Incredibly large percentage every year for as long as the tally has been kept has come from whistleblowers. For good reason, too, because in many cases, the whistleblower has intimate knowledge of the fraud. As an agent or a prosecutor, what better source of information is someone who was there in the hospital or the doctor's offices who were privy to the practices giving you inside information? Those are good sources of cases and frequent sources of cases.
The whistleblower will get some percentage of the recovery if they recover funds, if they recover lost funds. The whistleblower gets some decent percentage of that. Is that correct?
Yes, usually up to 30%. And so many of these cases are multi-million dollar cases, sometimes $100 million cases, maybe, you know, they're $1 or $2 billion settlements. If you can get 30% of that for whistleblowing, that's not a bad day's work.
Wow. All right. So we can see that the whistleblower is somewhat incentivized. Now the wheels are turning. Like the physician who's listening could be like, could I be a whistleblower or am I going to jail? Like, which way could this thing go?
The law has also addressed whistleblowers who participated in the fraud. The theory frequently has been if you participated in a fraud, you're not allowed to recovery. Why should you be rewarded for fraud? But the law has said in many cases is becoming more relaxed. One of the kind of the hallmark cases that we saw several years ago was a case where an individual, this is not a healthcare context, this was in a, like a banking context where an individual reported the Swiss banking fraud scandal. He was part of it. And the government eventually prosecuted that individual and said that you were not forthcoming and we're going to send you to jail. And so they did. But in the end, there was a lot of brouhaha about prosecuting what they considered the most important whistleblower in years. He had his sentence reduced dramatically. And if I'm not mistaken, $104 million reward for whistleblowing.
Oh my gosh, what a turn of events.
Yeah.
There are some new programs too that are piloted under the Biden administration to really sweeten the deal for whistleblowers. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, there's a few, really two really big ones that they came up with and touted. There was the senior DOJ officials commenced on a roadshow where they spoke at conferences to tout this new program. And they encouraged whistleblowers to come forward to incentivize them more. And one of the more common ones that they talked about was they said that there was four particular areas we're interested in. And one of the four was healthcare. So they were attempting to obtain more healthcare cases. And they said that these were for whistleblowers where there was a gap and there was not a reward in place already. And so they wanted to fill that gap where healthcare whistleblowers of all sorts and natures and types could and would be incentivized.
Wow. Okay. So everyone's head is probably spinning and thinking about all the ways that some employee that's not happy with their practice could lodge some sort of complaints or allegations or ask for people to get investigated. And I'm hoping that they do have some sort of a way to weed out the really baseless whistleblower complaints.
They should. The agents who receive this whistleblower complaint should perform a robust investigation to determine if fraud was actually committed. And then when there's not, or if it's a gray area, they should not proceed with the prosecution. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case all the time, but that's the way it should work. There are professional whistleblowers out there. There's one whistleblower out there who's documented that she has successfully obtained 5 whistleblower awards. And there were 6, she's filed 6 whistleblower cases. The 6 is we're uncertain whether she was rewarded or whether that case was dropped. But in each situation, there she received several million dollars.
Wow.
There are these people out there who do that for
a living. Like a career.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Right. We could all just leave medicine and become professional whistleblowers, it sounds like. My gosh. Okay. Yeah, that actually blows my mind. And I have a lot of questions about that, but I'll save them for another time. Mostly like, who keeps hiring this person?
Yeah. You got to wonder why they don't do a background check and determine that this is the same person who's filed numerous.
That is very interesting. All right. So now that we've scared everybody out of their minds, can you give us some success stories? Give us some hope. I actually just read about an orthopedic surgeon who prevailed in court. There was a trial. And this was a crazy case. It was like a pharmaceutical representative who had been in the OR who then made some whistleblower allegation that he wasn't doing the things that he documented that he did. And then the orthopedist was able to prove that that was patently false. But he had to work pretty hard to do it. But he did win. He did win.
I'm familiar with that case. And he did win. He was acquitted. It was a slugfest, a multi-year slugfest, where a lot of time and money was spent defending this doc. And he obtained no guilty verdict. And so when I say no guilty and acquittals, I use those terms synonymously. And so there are acquittals. So a good result in these cases, the best result, is the government drops his case. So the government does not proceed. In many ways that happens, the agent or the prosecutor realizes that this is not a good case. There's no fraud here, or they can't prove fraud. Other times, the defense attorney will make a compelling case that there was no fraud and this is not the kind of case you want to bring. And maybe there could be some indications that, you know, we're going to fight you tooth and nail. You could lose your well-touted 90-something percent prosecution success ratio could be undermined. Those are the best ways to resolve a case. The other way is to go to trial and to win, to get a full acquittal. And there are cases where docs are acquitted. There was one recently here in my jurisdiction in Texas where there was a full acquittal for a doc. And then there was the one that you mentioned. There's another one which I'm familiar with, which was in Kentucky. The doctor was fully acquitted of charges of healthcare fraud for controlled substance. It was a weird case where there was a undercover agent going in and seeing if he can get opioids and obtaining opioids each time. And then usually after a very short visit, I assume the government thought they had an ironclad case, but the doctor presented extenuating information to say, no, I was not intentionally committing fraud, or I wasn't committing fraud at all. You have it all wrong. And so there was an acquittal in that case and several other acquittals. It's just many of these cases do not make it to trial. And I think there would be more acquittals if more cases went to trial.
Interesting. Yeah, people just, they sort of cry uncle, and then you work out a money settlement and hope that it would just go away after that. I actually, and we'll see if I come back with this, I'll have to get back in touch with him. Someone, a listener, got in touch with me after he won at trial in a case involving the DOJ, the allegations by the government, and he went to trial and he won. And he would like to come talk about it. So I'm going to reach back out to him and see if he's interested in coming on and telling his story. But all of this is actually really important. I know people don't like hearing about it because it's frightening. And the thought of being investigated by anybody in the government is absolutely terrifying, and a league almost beyond what it feels like to get named in a civil malpractice suit. However, I think that since the scrutiny is increasing with the use of AI, the numbers of cases that they're bringing is increasing, everybody really should just know that obviously keeping their practice as clean as possible is important. You know, record keeping is extraordinarily important, but also knowing that there are people like you, Tony, who do this work and they do it well. And that's going to be your first call, is to one of these attorneys, and to read your policy before you ever need it, to understand whether or not there is a way that your defense could be paid for. That would be a game changer for a lot of people in terms of defending themselves. So know your policy, people. I say this all the time. Know what's in your policy. Tony, thank you so much for coming and enlightening us. We'll have you come back at some other time because, you know, so many questions. But this was a great high-level overview, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. I just want to say that I believe in docs, many of them. There are bad actors, as I said before. And many people understand that doctors need to make a living. And in the government, sometimes there's a theory that all doctors are greedy and doctors are scamming the system. But we should push back. Doctors, lawyers, anybody who knows about these types of cases should push back on that theory. And I think, as you said, Jada, many of the cases which make it to trial, in a malpractice case, the doctor wins. Individuals and juries realize that doctors, that this is a complicated area. Doctors make a mistake where doctors are unaware of all the rules and regulations, and sometimes they may run afoul but running afoul and making a mistake does not equate to a False Claims Act in every case. There are people out there that are fighting a good fight and understand and know that doctors need to make a living.
Thank you. And thank you for fighting the fight for us. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you again to Anthony Box with his wealth of expertise for coming to explain some of these situations to us. And stay tuned because I've got an interview with a physician who was investigated and prosecuted by the government, went to court, and won.